Larry, so nice to see you back on this podcast.
Yeah. Where I belong every Friday.
Yeah. Larry, let's get started with the conflict in the Middle East and the latest talk of Netanyahu, in which he was addressing the problem in Gaza. He was talking in the map that he was showing us, there was no the West Bank in that map. Yeah. Seems that they're considering that West Bank part of Israel. I'm going to play the clip that he was talking about.
Over the years, until we left that place, this is the state of Israel, this is Egypt, and you can see the Gaza Strip. It is not far from Tel Aviv, not far from Beersheba, and it's, of course, just meters away from the Gaza envelope. But we had an international border, which was from the sea all the way to Eilat. That was the international border of Israel. I would like, if I can, to zoom in. And if you look at this while zooming in, you see that all of these borders, the Navy, the Marine border is ours, but the land border is not. Ashkelon, Sderot, the Kibbutzim, Kerem Shalom, and down below, the Philadelphia Corridor, all the way down to Rafah, all of these are under Israeli control. The Philadelphia Corridor, which separates Egypt from the Gaza Strip, will not be evacuated. If Israel will give up control of it, Gaza will become an enclave of terror. When I resigned from the government, when I realized that they were going to do the disengagement and they were going to break up these Jewish communities, I gave my letter of resignation to Prime Minister Sharon, and I said in it that the minimum requirement of mine was to leave the Philadelphia Corridor in Israeli control. So it's nothing new. It was clear that if we do not have this route, they will be getting armed. They will create a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's the monster. I mean, what the Israelis are doing, these Zionist fanatics are committing monstrous crimes against the Palestinian people. But, you know, it wasn't an oversight or a mistake. It was deliberate that he excluded the West Bank, which is Palestinian territory. And he just, you know, revealed, tipped his hand, that the only thing that Netanyahu with his ultra-religious Zionist cronies have in mind is the extermination of the Palestinian people. They're not going to negotiate, not serious negotiations. It's not like they're going to come to an agreement to live side by side in peace, to coexist. They don't want to coexist. They want them to die. And they don't care if they go away or they die or they get blown up. Israel's going to try to eliminate them. The problem Israel has is it doesn't have the military force to do so without destroying itself. And this war has now drug on 11 months, or 11 plus months. So we're now at September 6th, and 30 more days from now, or 31 more days from now, is the anniversary of the Hamas invasion into Israel, or the Hamas fighting back, however you want to call it. So this is, there's no immediate end in sight, at least one that's available through peace talks. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, because the Turkish official, one of the Turkish officials, he was talking about that in 2 weeks we're going to have some sort of agreement. I don't know what he was talking. Is the United States still thinking of having a political settlement?
Well, sure. I'm sure they are. They're thinking, yeah, we got this in the bag. You saw Blinken today. I think he was commenting, we got 90% agreement. Well, there's only 10% of the issues separating us. And then CNN goes and asks Netanyahu, was that right? And Netanyahu goes, he shit all over it. No, we have nothing to agree with. They keep changing their position. I mean, it's just, as long as Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, and Smotrich are in the positions they're in, they are. There is not any possible prospect of an agreement. There are some Israelis, like Defense Minister Gallant, who can be a little more pragmatic. They're not going to eliminate their ultimate long-term goal, which is to eliminate the Palestinians. I mean, let's be clear about that. But they also recognize Israel can't keep doing what it's doing right now and survive, because it's like a bleeding wound, and you lose enough blood at some point, you pass out. And Israel is bleeding economic resources. Israel is bleeding actual human life, that its soldiers are not just the ones killed on the battlefield, but the ones coming back are suffering from post-traumatic stress. And that's created some real psychological issues for these mostly guys. And it's going to linger on. So let's put it this way, Israel's not in a stronger military position today than it was a year ago. Compare and contrast that with what the Russia is. Russia is in a far stronger, more superior position today than it was at the start of that special military operation in February 2022. So, I mean, you got two different conflicts, but in this one, Israel's not getting stronger. They're getting weaker. And the irony is that while there have been, tens of thousands of Palestinians murdered by Israeli strikes on civilian targets, that Hamas has not died out. Hamas is recruiting and adding to its numbers in spite of it. So, hopefully that puts it in perspective.
You remember on Monday, we talked about those six Israelis that they were killed. And it seems that Hamas was responsible for that. And they were talking about this. What's your latest information on that?
Yeah, I don't know anything beyond that. That it looks like that the Israelis were poised to make a rescue, that they were making noise, and that the six were there, and Hamas shot them. Said, okay, you don't want to negotiate, we'll shoot them. They're keeping the others alive. It's sad. It's awful. The Israelis want to make a big deal about it. Hamas killed our six. Well, Israel's killed 1,000 more in its prisons. And that's part of the problem. Each side, they're only looking at this is what you did to me. And, anybody that's that kind of fight where, who threw the first rock? And it really doesn't matter anymore. Each side is so aggrieved that they're unwilling to forgive or seek peace with the other side.
Yeah. Whenever we talk about the conflict in Ukraine, I believe we cannot emphasize enough the importance of Germany for the support that goes to Ukraine from the European Union. And yeah. When it comes to the Middle East, I think that role is played by Turkey. And Turkey is so important for what's going on between Gaza and Israel, because they have some sort of leverage on Israel. And do you think, we've seen that in Turkey, they're just protesting against the United States presence in Izmir and the US warship, and they're believing that this presence is to support Israelis. And we have protests. You saw the pictures coming out of Turkey.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going on? What's your take on what's happening right now in Turkey?
Well, and let's look what happened today that I think is going to further exacerbate the tensions and push Turkey into taking more aggressive action against Israel. A Turkish citizen who's also an American citizen, a woman, was shot in the head by the Israeli Defense Forces. She's unarmed, but that's what they do. So this is setting off protests in Turkey. And it's also forced the United States State Department to come out and make a pretty strong condemnation of the Israelis. So then this comes on the heels of news this past week that Turkey is going to apply for as a member of BRICS. And in joining BRICS, they're really separating themselves from NATO and from the EU. They basically decided they're never going to be accepted into the EU. And frankly, why would they? I mean, right now, the BRICS nations, their combined GDP is significantly greater than that of the G7, you know, the Europeans and the Americans. So it makes some sense for Turkey, and Turkey's been trying to get into the European Union for 30 years. And they keep basically being told no because you're a bunch of stinking Muslim foreigners. We don't want you. So it looks like they finally got the message. And so in announcing this move, Turkey is aligning itself closer with Russia, with China. Up to this point, it still allowed the oil to flow to Israel. Once it cuts off that oil, Israel is going to face some significant challenges on the economic front beyond what it's already facing. So we have to wait and see. But once Turkey is no longer a trusted member of NATO, or no longer sees itself as having an obligation to NATO, moves away from that, it's devastating for NATO, because Turkey represents the second largest army in NATO, and probably in terms of competence is as good as, if not better than, the U.S. Army right now. So, you know, Turkey's got a significant role to play.
Yeah. The United States has brought its forces from the Far East to the Middle East in order to support Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they have everything right now in the Middle East to support Israel against Iran.
Yeah.
Do you think how long they can stay there, Larry? And because it doesn't seem Iran is in any sort of rush to attack Israel.
That you put your finger on. I think with each passing day, the strain on those ships' crews grows. Because keep ready. Stay ready. You can only stay in that alert readiness level for so long before you start to actually deteriorate and lose capability and function. And then at the same time, what you're looking at is the wear and tear on the ships. And if they're firing off any airship, air defense missiles, then they are... they have to actually go to port to get those reloaded. So I've described it and it's a little crude, but I love the analogy. You know, the Viagra ads, and they start saying, boy, you know, if you stay alert for more than 4 hours, go see a doctor. Well, these guys, they're past that four-hour stage, you know, and it ends up degrading their functionality. So I think Iran is quite content to just it puts a stress on the United States. It does. It doesn't make us stronger. Doesn't make us better. And so we're out there sailing around, and probably the minute we start sailing away is when then Iran will say, okay, now we're going to strike back.
Yeah. The other thing, Larry, would be the situation right now in the United Kingdom. It seems that Jeremy Corbyn was asking the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom about the help that goes from the UK to Israel. Here is the answer coming from the...
You see, he'd also be very well aware that the world has condemned Israel for its illegal occupation of the West Bank, the settlement policy, and the killing of 40,000 people in Gaza. The suspension of some arms contracts, could he explain what effect that will actually make on Israel's ability to continue the bombardment of Gaza, or will it continue unabated? And will he also explain what role, legally or otherwise, Britain has played in overflying Gaza with surveillance aircraft and the use of RAF Akrotiri as a staging point for aircraft going to Israel, which many people believe are carrying weapons that are used to bomb Gaza?
Foreign Secretary.
I know that the Right Honourable Gentleman is informed on many aspects of these issues. He must know that our exports to Israel amount to about 1%. And in fact, it is the United States and Germany and others that are much more engaged in the selling of arms to Israel. So when he asked me the effect, he can draw his own conclusions in relation to that. I am very comfortable with the support that we give to Israel, and I won't comment on operational issues as he would expect from this dispatch box.
Yeah. Do you understand him? He says 1%, but at the end of the day, what does it mean?
They're facilitating murder. Britain really is, I don't think they're in a position where they could compel Israel to stop doing what it's doing. If the UK came out strongly against Israel, yeah, it would be, it would have some effect on Israel's conduct of the war. But the one that holds the reins of power here is the United States. Joe Biden, Blinken, they can put a stop to this killing right now. Just say, hey, you're not getting another dime. You're not getting another bullet or another piece of ammunition or artillery shell or Patriot missile. Nothing. You're cut off. This stops. And then, the United States would need to get engaged seriously with Russia and China to really work out a peace deal that could separate the sides and then allow the rebuilding to go on that needs to take place. But Gaza can no longer be treated as a largest concentration camp in the world. It needs to be treated as an actual country with the people are free to move about and to leave if they want. So this is, the Brits are no longer an important player in anything. They're very malevolent. They're very malicious. They can cause a lot of problems, but they're not a military power. Yeah, they've got some nukes, but it's even questionable where they can get them launched off their subs. Their aircraft carrier has been a disaster. They've got like two of those now functioning. Their 70,000 man army, that's it. And of those, the number that could be deployed in combat is something probably around 25,000 to 30,000 tops. It's just they're a joke, but they've got these delusions of grandeur, think that they're still relevant, and try to throw their weight around on the world stage, and are happy to try to create as much mayhem as possible.
Yeah, and shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine right now, Zelensky, do you understand what the Biden administration going to do? They're just saying that they want to send more aid to Ukraine. And Lloyd Austin said that, and Zelensky is going to talk with Biden to convince him about his objectives right now. He's going to win, how he's going to defeat Russia. Do they really believe that they can continue this conflict? Because right now with the situation of the Ukrainian army, it doesn't seem to be that would be the case for Ukraine.
Well, objectively, if they were looking at objective facts, you're right, that the conclusion they would draw is this thing's over, the party's over, and time to figure out how to bring all this to an end. But I think listening to remarks that Lloyd Austin made earlier today and Rammstein, they're still believing their own bullshit. They're kidding themselves. They're indulging in self-delusion, and at least they're going to keep publicly continue to provide vocal support to Zelensky. And it wouldn't surprise me that they equip him with some JSAMs and give him the green light. Yeah, go ahead and fire on Moscow. And if that happens, then this war is going to enter a new phase. And it's not going to be good for Ukraine or the United States and Europe.
And here is what Sersky said on CNN about the situation of the Ukrainian army.
Of course, everyone wants the level of training to be the best. So we train highly qualified professional military personnel. At the same time, the dynamics at the front require us to put conscripted servicemen into service as soon as possible. That is why we conduct a compulsory basic military training for at least a month. And qualified training, which is at least 2 weeks a month.
Yeah, at least 2 weeks a month.
Oh, well, so, you know, I wrote, you remember the article I wrote 2-3 days ago about training. It's the training, stupid. And he just made the case for me. Normal basic training is not 1 month. That's 4 weeks. Normal basic training, just the basic, learning the rudimentary, the fundamental skills, is 13 weeks. That's 3 months. Then after that, once you've got the sort of the basics, like you may have been introduced to how to manage a compass, how to load and fire your rifle, how to properly keep yourself clean. You know, when you're out in the field, you don't have usually don't have regular toilets to use, as just an example. And there's an entire bunch of training about how to avoid getting yourself sick because you don't have proper hygiene practices and the proper use of a latrine or an outdoor toilet as an example. That's all in basic. But then comes the advanced individual training. So, you know, hey, here, Nima, you're going to become a mortar guy. You're going to shoot mortars. So get over here and we're going to teach you how you load them, how you aim them, how you adjust fire. A lot of it involves mathematics and calculations, and you got to move. So, and that takes a while. That's usually like another 3 months right there. Or, hey, we're going to teach you how to drive a tank or how to be a loader in a tank or be an armored personnel vehicle guy. You know, all sorts of jobs. But that's what's called advanced individual training. Well, that's another 3 months. So at a minimum, to get a soldier is still inexperienced. Even after all that training, they're inexperienced, but at least they've got some level of competence through some knowledge that they've acquired. 6 months, they get to the front line. These guys are putting them out there after 6 weeks, maybe. They're inadequately trained, and one of the consequences of that poor training is that there are a lot of what they call friendly fire incidents, some of which include soldiers fragging, where they deliberately kill their officers because they think the officers are pricks, and sometimes they are. So, you know, when you get this kind of poor training, and they're going up against Russian forces who on a minimum have 6 months to 9 months training before they're deployed into combat roles. So, you know, Russia's been planning for this and preparing for this. Ukraine hasn't.
Larry, right now, do we have any information that how many Ukrainian forces have been killed in the Kursk region?
The Russians report over 10,000. So, the Russian Ministry of Defense.
10,000 out of 12, out of 20?
Yeah, we don't know how many initially were. Let's just say it was 20. Okay, that's 50% casualties.
Yeah.
Significant loss. It may be higher than that because they're now, you know, they're now basically caught. They just can't run back across the border and escape to safety because the Russians have now controlled the road network with both artillery and aircraft.
And how about the front line in the Donbas region? Is the Donbas region is totally in the hand of Russians right now, and they're going beyond that?
Well, the Ukraine still occupies about a third of the Donetsk Republic, and Russia has been not just chipping away at that, it has been rolling the Ukrainians back at a significant pace. And the city of Pokrovsk is on the menu for the Russians. Now, when will they take it? A lot of that hinges upon how fiercely the Ukrainians are going to dig in and try to survive. If they dig in and try to make it a Bakhmut, you know, it could wind up being a 3 or 4 month experience. But I think the reality on the casualty front, what Ukraine is suffering, when you go through the numbers that are being published, it looks like an average of 2,300 a day. Well, you compare that with a year ago, it was only like 700 a day. So they're losing three times more of the soldiers and equipment than they were losing a year ago. And the Ukraine can't physically keep up this level of loss and stay intact as a country.
It seems that the city of Pokrovsk is so important for the Ukrainian army. They're using this city as a hub to just provide ammunition to their branches. And
well, it's like it's very similar in function to the city of Baston in Belgium during World War II. Now, it wasn't a big city, but it was a place where all of these different road networks came together and went out. So Pokrovsk is in the same situation, that the railroad lines go through there. And the road networks, critical road networks that are used to provide reinforcements and supplies go out of there. So yeah. Once it falls, it's going to be a devastating blow. And even before it falls, the Russians are close enough that they're exerting some fire control over the railroads and the highways. So the units that are farther away from Pokrovsk, they're going to be suffering from supply shortages.
Germany, Netherlands, and Denmark are going to send new tanks to Ukraine. And how we can understand the behavior of Germany right now with the rise of the right wing and the left wing, yeah. Both of them are against this type of policy. And right now, the Green Party, it seems that they're continuing this in the same manner that they have been doing for more than 2 years.
Well, yeah, and the Green Party, if you recall, originally in its origin days, man, they were as anti-war as you could be. Now they're you know, more pro-war than Goebbels was for the Germany during World War II, or Hermann Göring. You know, it's outrageous. So right now they've not had to pay a physical price. And if they continue supplying like this and those supplies are used in a way that hurts the Russians may be retaliating on Poland or in Germany. You know, they've been pretty clear about that they're not going to sit back and allow the Germans, the Dutch, the Poles to take shots at them, or the Swedes, which is, you know, that's one of the things the Russians sent a very clear message to the rest of NATO this week. with that strike at Poltava. They killed a bunch of Swiss. They may be a military, they may have been military contractors, but what they were Swedish, I'm sorry, not Swiss, Swedish instructors in electronic warfare capabilities. May also have been some Poles killed and some Germans. So the Russians are sending a message. We're not playing anymore. And if you're going to play in this arena, we may kill you.
And in this interview, Sersky was claiming that Russians didn't advance in the Pokrovsk a meter.
He's just lying. I mean, you know, they can tell themselves, and go ahead, lie to yourself. It doesn't make the Russians weaker. And he may think it's going to help his troops fight on and be more positive. But when you're up there getting chewed up and getting shot at and you're outnumbered, you realize right away that your commanders are lying to you. And at some point, if the lies grow great enough, people just say, I've had it, I'm out. And they'll just give up.
What's so amazing about Netanyahu, whenever he talks in English and in Hebrew, and he talks to the audience and he just delivers different messages for his objectives. Right now, do you think are we seeing the same type of manner on the part of the Zelensky administration? These things that they're talking about on CNN, for example, NBC, Zelensky was on NBC talking, having an interview. Do you think they're saying something different from what they're saying in Ukraine to their population, to their audience?
No. I think they're sending the same. I mean, they're lying to the United States and they're lying to the Ukrainian people. They're not telling them the real truth. You do have that one member of the Rada. I forget her name, but she's been pretty outspoken about the problems that Ukraine is actually facing. And so far, she hasn't been locked up and put away. So she's speaking out, but her words are just diametrically opposed by Zelensky and the other members of his cabinet, newly formed cabinet, by the way.
Yeah, in Zelensky's interview was one of the points that was so important. The interviewer was asking him if they're going to do the same kind of attack as we had in the Kursk region, and he was saying that I'm not gonna talk about it. Do you think are they gonna before 2024? It seems that Democratic Party they're doing everything with this government in Ukraine.
Yeah,
for the sake of 2024, do you think they're gonna do the same before the election?
No, you mean the United States come through with more aid and try?
No, I'm talking about just providing intelligence to the Ukrainian army together with mercenaries to do some sort of attack on nuclear power plants that would be so significant, or another region at the border, just like the Kursk region.
No, I don't think so. Despite the insanity we've seen on the Biden side, I think they recognize that starting a war with Russia, or one they could escalate the conflict into actual, you know, shooting at each other, would be the last thing they want to have for going into an election. Some may have calculated that, oh yeah, this is going to unite people, bring them together, rally around the flag. But I don't think that it would have that effect now. It would be seen as a cynical ploy to rope us into a war that, and frankly, we would suffer the kind of losses we'd be suffering early on would be so significant that would raise serious questions about the judgment of those who took the decision to take us into that kind of war.
How did you find the new nuclear strategy of the Biden administration? We've learned, Scott Ritter wrote about it. He said the title is On a Highway to Hell. And Ted Postel wrote about it. And in your opinion, is that important right now? Is there something different from what we've seen so far? Are they trying to escalate the situation?
Yeah, well, they're playing, you know, they're playing with nuclear fire. They are raising this as something that could become likely. And, you know, it's forcing the Russians into changing what they're doing, too. You know, but they're playing with nukes. And it's, nukes are not a plaything. Just like I tell people, a gun, gun's not a toy. Guns are real. They can kill people. Don't play with them. This is the West playing. It's appalling. It's ridiculous, but that it's what they're going to do. And that's one of the concerns, that they're going to miscalculate, because they believe that the Russians are so weak and so distracted that we can do whatever we want and it won't matter. Well, I don't believe that at all. But it certainly appears that there are some in the Biden administration that are thinking that way and acting that way.
It seems that the outcome of this strategy would be the strategy of preemption. It means that if you feel they wanted to attack you, you attack them first and with nuclear bombs.
Yeah, yeah.
Here comes the problem, Larry. And we know if something big happens, the European Union gonna be devastated. And maybe in the United States, they're thinking of the European Union as a buffer zone, and they can sacrifice the European Union, the European countries,
right,
in order to have some sort of nuclear conflict with Russia or even China.
Yeah, well, that's what the United States is counting on, that if that happens, that it's going to be Europe that suffers and not us. But the Russians, Lavrov, Rybakov, Putin, I think they've all been pretty clear that they are going to make the United States pay. The United States will pay a price, that it's not going to be able to be isolated and free of harm. And that's one of the things that's on the table. It's dangerous.
Just to wrap up the session, Larry, how do you find the new policies on RT and Sputnik? And they're talking about the interference coming from RT to the U.S.
election,
2024 presidential election. Do they have any sort of evidence, or they're making everything?
Well, let's start a list of countries that the United States has interfered in, meddled in their domestic politics of late. Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Venezuela, Russia, Georgia, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. You know, we can go on. We'd be here all day. So the hypocrisy of this. This is like the United States is like the woman that owns the largest whorehouse in Europe, and lecturing teenagers about not having sex in the backseat of their car. You know, it's like, here you are pandering and promoting prostitution on a massive scale, and you're going to sit there and lecture Russia, unquote, meddling in U.S. elections? Number one, on the question of meddling in U.S. elections, we have solid evidence, conclusive proof, that the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, and the CIA all played a role in fabricating claims that Russia was meddling in the 2016 election. They lied then. They're lying now. They're raising this as this red herring to say, oh, it's Russia again. Russia's meddling in our election, while ignoring the fact that the United States Congress just a couple of months ago appropriated almost $4 billion that's being used to meddle in foreign countries' elections. 315 million, I believe, goes for the National Endowment of Democracy for Democracy. They're big meddlers. They were big meddling in Georgia. You got another 300 million that is a set up in what they call counter Russian influence funds. Then you got $2.9 billion that are, quote, promoting democracy money. But what do they mean by promoting democracy? Imagine you go out and you hire a bunch of foreigners, a bunch of people in another country to do what you want them to do. And now we're not even talking about what CIA money is pumped in covertly. The United States, in terms, you know, is outraged that RT, which is a news organization, is broadcasting, quote, propaganda. What is it? List the propaganda. Give us the list. No, they don't. Because RT's not pushing propaganda. I've said many times, I have been, the first time I appeared on RT was back in 2016, I believe. And at the time I was asked about the Russiagate and the evidence, I laid out evidence I had back then of that this was, you know, a false accusation and ginned up. And all the times I've appeared on RT, in contrast to being on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, ABC, all the major news networks, they would always, those new major news networks would always do a pre-interview with me to say, hey, what are you going to say? And if they didn't like what I was going to say, they wouldn't have me on. They would censor me. Oh, you can't say that. We don't want to hear that. I have never had a pre-interview with RT. Never. And like I said, I've been on their show probably more than 100 times now, going back over the last 6 or 8 years. So they, you know, they don't tell me what to say. They don't plant words in my head. I get to speak what I'm saying. And it's the United States, though. I mean, if truth be told, it's not just the U.S. government. U.S. media, if we're going to apply the same standard of RT, because here's RT doesn't even get to broadcast in the United States. It's almost impossible to find. Now, you can watch it online as long as they don't block your internet. But the United States, you got Fox News, you got CNN, CNN International, you got NBC News, MSNBC. Yeah, the United States is broadcasting its propaganda all over the world. It's okay because it's us. We're special. So, you know, it's just this attack by the likes of Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray. They're allowing illegal immigrants to flood our borders and register to vote illegally in the United States. And they're worried about Russia meddling. It's ridiculous.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
All right. My pleasure.
Great pleasure.
We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Nima.
Talk to you on Monday.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.